Welcome to the Leadership Journey podcast. My name is Alan Wilson. I'm the host of the podcast. And each week on the podcast, we try to give you the opportunity to reflect on some of the things that make up a leadership journey.
Well, today I'm very glad to welcome Archdeacon David McClay to the podcast. Welcome, David. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
David, just a question for the benefit of any non-Anglicans who are listening. What is an archdeacon?
Well, I think the official answer is that deacons are people who serve, and the archdeacon is somebody who is supposed to come alongside other deacons and encourage them in their work of ministry and service. And I think officially one of the roles that we've got is to help identify people for ministry.
Okay, and where do you fit into the whole administrative structure then in your diocese?
Well, I'm currently rector of the parish of Willowfield, but I'm released from that 2 days a week to work in the diocese of Dundrumore.
Okay, right. Well, we'll get to exploring some of what life looks like as both as a parish minister and also as an archdeacon. And I know there are other areas involvement with New Wine that we'll want to talk about as well. But let's go back to the beginning. Just talk us through maybe the stages of life that have brought you to the point where you are today.
Well, I grew up in Donegal. Grew up on a farm in South Donegal, in a very sort of loving, caring, supportive family environment. I'm the eldest of four children. And actually my parents are still both alive, my mum 85, my dad almost 90. So that was a sort of a stable, loving, hard working, you know, there was a very strong sort of work ethic in my home. Went to boarding school in the Royal in Raphoe. As a child,
which was famous for its hockey, of course. Well, I remember actually.
I'm afraid I wasn't a hockey player, but
I remember one playing once in a cup match up there. Well, in fact, I was a substitute, unused substitute up there. It was a fairly passionate Saturday morning of hockey.
Yeah, well, sport has never been my strong point.
Right. So you boarded there then?
Boarded there, and then left school as one does at 17, and went into industry, worked for a clothing firm in Donegal town called McGee's of Donegal. Worked in their warehouse to start with, and then worked in their sales office. And during those years, began to really explore some of the things that I'd been taught as a child, and began to question and really search around the whole issue of faith and God. Is God real?
Had you been brought
up?
I'd been brought up in a
Christian home. I'd been brought up in the Church of Ireland, in a small rural traditional Church of Ireland context, and I began to find myself connecting with and meeting other young Christians from further afield, and that began to impact me and began to challenge me.
When you say further afield, you mean geographically or from other traditions as
both,
well?
Both, actually. I got involved in something called Christian Endeavour in my late teens, and that connected me with other young adult Christians right across Ireland, actually. And that really led to, I suppose, faith coming alive. It led to a real commitment to Christ, where I made a very conscious decision to give my life to Christ, to follow Christ, to live for Christ.
Yeah, I'm just realizing, you know, some people may say you'd begun talking about questions that you were asking. Can you just go back a little bit and talk about some of the kinds of things that you were questioning about what you'd been taught?
Yeah, I suppose it, basic questions like, you know, is this real? Does God exist? If God does exist, why is the world such a mess?
Yeah.
Other questions then around morality. Do I really want to follow a Christian moral code or not? And for a number of years as a teenager in my late into my late teens, the jury was out for me as to whether I did or didn't.
Yeah.
So it was a season of really searching and being convinced, probably convinced, first of all, through quietly on my own reading the scriptures, and also convinced through conversations and just observing the lifestyle of some people that I was having conversations with.
Well, when you made this commitment to follow Christ, then was there a, would you say there was a dramatic change in your life, or was it not so dramatic?
I probably would have said that there wasn't,
yeah.
But actually others would have said that there was.
I
remember one day being challenged in my workplace and somebody saying, "McLay, what is it with you? Have you become one of these Christians or something?" Because there was a definite change, yeah, and there was a definite change, I suppose, in my priorities and the things that I wanted to give myself to. And there was a definite change in how I wanted to actually deal with people as well.
Right. Can you say more about that?
I suppose I would have been very ambitious in terms of the firm that I worked in, and I loved what I did, but I probably wouldn't have always been the gentlest soul in the world.
Right.
I'm still not, but certainly, without a relationship with Jesus Christ, I think my values and my priorities would be very different.
Right. Okay. Well, was there any evidence, since this is a discussion about leadership journeys, was there evidence at that stage, even in your late teens, around the time you were involved with Christian Endeavour, of leadership? Did anybody recognise leadership qualities in you back then?
I think one of the things that happened, and I found myself in a church with a rector that was a permission giver.
Right.
And who allowed us as young adults, you know, I was 18, 19, to do all sorts of things, from organising youth services to organising outreach events. And I found myself in an environment where, by being given permission, I was allowed to both succeed and to fail.
Right.
Which I think was really important. I also found myself rubbing shoulders with folks who were real leaders, and I think that had an impact upon me from those early years as well. And I think being allowed to take risks was really significant.
I'll come back to some of those people, some of those leaders that you observed.
Yeah.
I'd like to come back to that in a moment. But just in terms of the stages, how long did you stay with McGee's? Obviously,
okay, I came to Christ when I was 18. I was currently working for McGee's at that stage. I continued in that role and in a number of different roles, mostly in sales, until I was 25. At 25, I went off to Trinity in Dublin to train for the Church of Ireland ordained ministry.
Okay, what made you decide to do that?
Well, prior to that, I had a bit of an ongoing, I think, tussle with God, really, where I was trying to figure out, was there something else I could do? And so I became a lay reader in the Church of Ireland, and I thought, well, if I do that, I can continue in business.
Okay.
I got involved in youth work at a diocesan level, became the diocesan youth advisor, and I thought, okay, if I really do all of this other stuff on the side, maybe God will leave me alone, because I really was reluctant in terms of going into ministry in any sort of paid capacity, really, because I really loved what I did in McGee's, and I think there was a bit of me that really would have loved to pursue a career in sales.
So it wasn't so much a fear of, goodness, I could never be part of the established church or something like that.
I suppose, in truth, I didn't know anything other than the established church in the early 1980s.
The reason I ask it is there's someone that I chatted with a while back about their leadership story, And he talked about having done, he decided to go to university and study sociology. And he talked about how he thought God would be very pleased with him because, well, sociology is something he could use to serve God with. But God actually wanted him in the ministry. And I remember him talking to me about a total reversal of his plans where, you know, a number of things happened. And just him learning, really, that you don't just go to God and say, well, God, here's my plan. You should be happy with it. Do you know, so it's more that kind of thing, I suppose, that I'm getting at.
Yeah, I think actually from an early stage in my following of Jesus Christ, I really did believe, I think, that it was about following where he would lead.
Yeah.
Rather than asking him to join me on my journey.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm really, really thankful to a couple of people that really discipled me.
Yeah.
In that sort of way.
Let's talk about some of these early influencers then. Tell us a bit about them.
Well, my home rector was a guy called Charles Simpson, who at 60 had come across from England to take a parish in Ireland, my home parish. Mm-hmm. And he was just a permission giver who believed in me and who allowed me to get on the stuff. There was another rector in Donegal at that particular time, a man called Robert McKimmy, who had been a missionary in Uganda and in Kenya, and who was a native of Donegal, and who was a really godly man who loved the scriptures. And I was really privileged to be able to spend just time with him and to be discipled to some extent by him as well. And alongside that, the leaders of the Christian Endeavour group that I was part of and connected to in Pettigo, a Methodist couple, Douglas and Oliver Rowe, they were very intentional in just coming alongside, not just me, but a group of young people at that particular time, and really looking after us. Like, we went on holiday together, we did life together, and that was very formative. Built something by way of, in me, of the importance of Christian community, the importance of belonging, and the importance of creating an environment in terms of church and in terms of who we are when we do ministry, that people can belong from the moment they begin to connect with us.
Yeah. Okay. So off to Trinity at 25, studying theology, divinity. What's your recollections of that? I should say for the listeners here, who, since this is not a vodcast, so there was a smile came on his face when I asked him that question.
Well, you know, the positive of all of that was that I made some incredibly good friends that have been lifelong friends and will be lifelong friends. It was a challenging environment in that there was a whole mix of theological views in the Church of Ireland Theological College at that particular time. Those were the years when there was quite a lot of students actually going through the college as well. And there was a whole spectrum of where people were at theologically, or I might not at theologically as well. So those were challenging years. I was single as well at that particular time, but engaged to be married. And it was a very sort of old-fashioned sort of mindset. Like, for example, we were allowed home from college 2 weekends a term as an engaged student.
Yeah.
That wouldn't just happen today.
Yeah.
The married men were allowed home every weekend but had to be in the college Monday to Friday.
Oh, really? Wow, right.
It really was quite a monastic environment.
Yeah.
And probably not the healthiest environment in lots of ways. But there were real positives. It was fun to live in Dublin. I was married at the end of my second year, so lived out of college for my last year. As I say, made some very good friends, and there were some hilariously funny and good times,
yeah,
in the midst of challenging times as well.
How did you cope with the theological challenges of all these diverse viewpoints that were there under one roof?
I probably coped in a way that is the way not to cope. I actually didn't take it very seriously.
Right.
I knew what I believed.
Yeah.
I also knew that I needed to get through these 3 years and get to the end of them and pass some exams.
Yeah.
So I simply focused on passing the exams that I needed to pass.
Right.
I did the bits that I really enjoyed, and I threw myself fully into the bits that I could enjoy.
Yeah.
And the rest I decided not to get too upset about.
Yeah.
The truth.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my coping mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
Some of my colleagues probably found it even more difficult than I did, because they would have analysed
mm-hmm.
absolutely everything mm-hmm. that they were being taught.
Yeah.
In truth, I analysed some of it and I chose to ignore some of it.
Right, okay. Yeah, yeah. So you come to the end of your time in Trinity, you're now married, and then a first church, a curacy?
Yeah, in those days you were interviewed for 5 curacies,
uh-huh.
5 possible places that you might end up, and if you were blessed, somebody would offer you a job. And I was offered a curacy in the parish of Marilyn.
Oh really? Right.
The rector at that time was a chap called Roland Hutchinson. Mm-hmm. And
I've heard a lot of people talk about him.
Yeah, lots of people still speak very affectionately
yeah.
of Roland. And so I went to Marilyn in June 1987 when I was ordained deacon, and I remained there until early 1990.
Okay.
Those were 3 great years. I loved working with Roland. He had the reputation of being a workaholic.
Uh-huh.
He had the reputation of being a very strong character, which he was. But he and I worked really happily. I loved him, really. I loved him as a person.
Yeah.
I loved working with him. And you know, I look back on those years as being actually really very formative.
Mm-hmm.
Roland was a very strong, bold, outrageously outspoken character. In a very godly sort of way. And there are times, I think, where probably I hear Roland in some of the things that I'm saying
yeah.
and in some of the ways that I
yeah.
react
yeah.
to church politics and to church life generally.
Yeah, right.
So those were 3 great years.
Marilyn's been quite a... I mean, that's why I live in Marilyn, and it's been quite a... Over the years, there's a number of... fairly well-known folk who've spent time
mm-hmm.
in the parish there. It seems that there's a kind of, you know, for what is really a very rural part of the country, it's produced quite a lot of folk who've
well,
gone on to...
In those days, you know,
significant ministry.
Marilyn Parish Church had a congregation of about 300 probably on a Sunday. Dollingstown, down the road, the Dollar Church back then had 70 or 80. There was a lot of people came to faith
uh-huh.
Over those few years, and in Rome's earlier ministry in the place as well. So there was a lot of young Christians, not necessarily people who were young in years,
yeah.
but who were young in faith.
Yeah.
And so there was a freshness, there was an energy,
yeah.
there was a vitality about the place
yeah.
That I just loved.
What would you, I mean, looking back on that, is it? Can you put your finger on anything? Was it because Roland was a very effective evangelist? Was there, you know, an unusual core of praying people? Was there? Have you ever thought
about
that?
I think both of those things yeah. actually are key among other things. There was a real strong praying group in the
yeah.
place. Like we met every morning to pray
yeah.
at one particular stage.
Okay.
Roland was an evangelist,
yeah.
and that was his great strength.
Mm-hmm.
In a particular sort of, I suppose, older style, Roland was a very evangelistic preacher,
yeah.
And so I learned a lot about how to preach evangelistically
mm-hmm.
from Roland. I remember the very first time I met Roland, and he had big farmer's hands. Mm-hmm. And I remember him laying these hands on me and praying, God, make this man a soul winner. Mm-hmm. And that was a very profound moment, actually, mm-hmm. as I look back at it. Mm-hmm. Even as I shared with you, I've become quite emotional, mm-hmm. even talking about that.
Mm-hmm.
Because I do believe that God birthed something mm-hmm. in my heart over those years about the church existing for lost people.
Mm-hmm.
That the church exists for those that don't know Christ,
yeah.
and that they always need to be our priority as we go about
yeah.
How we structure church, how we do church,
yeah.
how we do life.
Right.
That without Christ, people are lost,
yeah.
And that is more than some sort of theory, but it's a reality, and it ought to actually energize and motivate us mm-hmm. and shape us for ministry mm-hmm. and indeed for Christian discipleship.
Yeah, yeah. So that was obviously it. That moment was formative, but those three
years,
were very formative.
Roland was great fun
mm-hmm.
To work with. He was totally outrageous in the things that he would say. And
we need examples.
Okay, I remember preaching a sermon one Sunday morning as a young man that could have got me in a lot of trouble. I won't go into the details of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I identified different people groups
mm-hmm.
that lived in that particular area.
Okay, right.
And said very boldly, that won't belong into this organisation or that organisation or some other organisation. Won't get you into heaven.
Uh-huh.
And by the time I'd finished, I'd clearly upset a lot of people. And but what Roland did before he announced the hymn that followed the sermon, he walked down one aisle and up the other, and as he walked down he put a hand on people's shoulder and he went, "My curate's right, it won't get you into heaven." Very boldly, very courageously. So suddenly he became the guy who was literally taking the flack on my behalf.
Yeah.
And I learned something in that. I learned that you need to, in leadership, be somebody that's willing to absorb criticism and pain for others, particularly those who are young and naive, as I was at that particular
mm-hmm.
stage.
Mm-hmm.
But also I learned something just about boldness and about courage.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Wow. After Marilyn, that's quite a school of ministry that you were in. Where was next?
So I'm at this stage married. I'm a dad as well. We've got a little girl, and Irene and Cherith, my wife Irene and daughter Cherith and I, we moved to Kilkeel.
Mm-hmm.
We moved there in January 1990,
mm-hmm.
and I would remain there until 2001.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the start of an 11-year.
Mm-hmm.
period in Kilkeel. Kilkeel was very different to Marilyn in some ways. It was a fishing, very beautiful place to live, very warm, albeit very strong people. A lot of builders and strong work ethic in the place. Strong expectation pastorally, but I took something with me from my curacy years around mission and evangelism, and so from early on decided to put reaching people that didn't know Christ at the very top of the agenda. And we were really privileged in the early years to see quite a number of pretty young people give their lives to Christ, and actually some of them are now in ministry.
That's exciting. So there till 2001.
Yeah, those were interesting and challenging years.
Right, tell us more about that.
Well, I was in Kilkeel all of 3 weeks when my wife Irene was diagnosed with breast cancer. And so that was really challenging. I was 30 years of age. She was 29. And so as a young couple, we were dealing with that and the implications of that. It turned out to be a very aggressive cancer, and despite surgery and despite ongoing chemotherapies, 3 and a bit years later, Irene died. So there were, I suppose, 3 and a bit years where I was the rector of Kilkeel, and at the same time the husband of a young woman who was dying of cancer, and trying to be a parent to a little toddler, you know, which wasn't still, he wasn't even primary school. Through those years, Irene died in May 1993. So then for a period of 3 plus years, I was a single parent with a daughter, 4 to 7 across those years. Still a rector of a local church, still trying to pastor people, still wanting to lead that church into growth and into ministry, still believing in God, and still loving the Lord, but hurting and lonely, and trying to work lots of stuff through my own, my own life.
How did you manage, David, would you say, to both to sustain your own faith, but also to sustain a ministry in those circumstances?
I think there's a number of factors in that. I think some of it was down to choice, actually. Choosing in the early days, certainly, every day to get out of bed, and every day choosing to follow Jesus Christ, and choosing every day to do the ministry that I needed to do, and choosing every day to try to be the dad that I wanted to be. Also choosing to do something with my grief and with my pain rather than internalize it. So I was very blessed, really, to have a couple of friends that I could be really honest with. And I was brutally honest with them. They were able to cope with my honesty, and they were very generously willing to make themselves available to listen to my hurt and to my pain as well. Well, secondly, I think a growing awareness that I wasn't on my own, actually, that this sort of thing does happen to other people, and the ability to actually move to a place where I was able to believe that God is always good, but life is not always good, and to separate those two things out, actually, was, I think, theologically really, really important. Over the course of those years, I very deliberately chose to read the scriptures a lot. And I very deliberately chose to ask people to pray into my life a lot. And so I took opportunities to even get to other, to go to other places and to get outside of Ireland even, on occasions, where I could receive prayer and ministry in a safe and almost anonymous sort of environment, where people didn't know my story, but where I could be really honest before God. So I remember, for example, going to a clergy week in Belfast that I'd been invited to. There was a group of about 10 clergy, and it was a week-long retreat. It was then led by people in New Wine England. I didn't know what New Wine England even was in those days. But for that week, I really met God in a deep, deep way. and the others who were there really met God in a deep, deep way as well. And those were, for me, days of incredibly deep healing, growing and an awareness of the presence of God. That the presence of God can be palpable and almost tangible. I think that the room actually shook on one occasion where we were praying. There was such a sense of God's presence. I travelled with on another occasion during those years to a church growth conference in Singapore. This was maybe 2 and a bit years after I'd been widowed. And I remember going forward for prayer at one particular point. And in truth, it wouldn't really have mattered what the invitation was for to come forward for prayer. I was choosing to receive prayer and to ask God to meet with me and to heal who I was so that I could become something in the future. And I remember being on my face, literally lying on my face at the front of this church and weeping and weeping and weeping. And sensing the Lord say, David, grief can become your identity, or you can allow me to give you a new identity. And I remember in the midst of all of that emotion and in the midst of all of that sense of the presence of God, the real presence of God to bring comfort, the phrase a new day began to just spin around in my head. A new day, a new day. And I remember getting up and taking off my wedding ring and walking back down to one of my colleagues who was there for the week as well and handing him my wedding ring and said, would you keep that safe for me until I get back home? Because my daughter might want to have it, but I don't need it any longer. And that was a decisive moment of actually acknowledging that the past had been wonderful and had been special, but actually I needed to step into an unknown at that point, new future. And I had no idea if that unknown new future was going to be celibacy for the rest of my life or whether I'd meet somebody else. I had no idea what that meant. But I knew that God would be in the middle of that and that God was with me in that. And I would go so far as to say I probably came home a different person from that trip to Singapore than what I'd gone there as.
Okay. David, we're going to take a pause here for this week. Thank you for sharing so personally. And, you know, very clearly those phases that you've talked about, your the curacy, the influence of Roland Hutchison, but then that very profound experience of grief and loss and yet finding God in that. Thank you for sharing so richly and so personally. We're going to leave your story there for this week. And you've talked about a new day and coming back as a new man. And that's going to be our starting point next week.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Leadership Journey podcast. Remember, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. And next week, we plan to be back with the rest of this interview with David McClay. Thank you.